Hello, everyone, and welcome to our WOMA podcast with our guest, the illustrious Dr. Robert Harrison, to further discuss the topic of silicosis, which he previously talked about at a webinar. My name is Dr. Rupesh Patel, and I'm a resident physician in occupational and environmental medicine at UCSF, and I am today's moderator and host. We have designed these podcasts as a tool and a benefit for members to stay current on topics of interest to occupational and environmental medicine physicians. The WOMA members involved in planning this podcast have no relevant financial relationships to disclose, and neither does our guest, Dr. Robert Harrison. Now, it's my pleasure to introduce our speaker for today. Dr. Robert Harrison is a public health medical officer with the California Department of Public Health Occupational Health Branch and clinical professor at the University of California, San Francisco, in the Division of Occupational and Environmental Medicine. He established the UCSF Occupational Health Services, where he has diagnosed and treated thousands of work and environmental injuries and illnesses. He has designed and implemented numerous medical monitoring programs for workplace exposures and has consulted widely with employers, healthcare professionals, and labor organizations on the prevention of work-related injuries and illnesses. Dr. Harrison has led many work and environmental investigations of disease outbreaks. He has served as a technical and scientific consultant to federal OSHA and CDC NIOSH. And was a member of the California Occupational Safety and Health Standards Board. His research interests include the collection and analyses of California and national data on the incidence of work-related injuries and illnesses. Dr. Harrison has authored or co-authored more than 75 peer-reviewed journal articles and more than 40 book chapters, contributed articles and letters to the editor. He is the co-editor of the most recent edition of the textbook, Occupational and Environmental Medicine. The focus of today's podcast is silicosis. And Dr. Harrison, I know you gave this wonderful webinar for WOMA. And for listeners who may be tuning into this podcast who may have missed that webinar, I wanted to give you the opportunity to summarize the main important points.
Thanks so much, Rupesh, for giving me the chance to talk with you a little bit more about this very important topic. Silicosis is a very old disease, dates back to Bernardino Ramazzini, or perhaps even before. That was 500 years ago. Dr. Ramazzini was an Italian doctor, and he wrote the first book about occupational diseases, and he wrote about silicosis and stone cutters. So I've been very familiar with silicosis dating back to my medical education, which, by the way, was not in the days of Bernardino Ramazzini, a little bit later in the 1970s. This is a new epidemic of a very old disease. And it comes from the invention of artificial stone countertops that date from the 1980s and then really emerged globally in the 1990s. Artificial stone countertops now are about 60 to 70% of countertop sales in the United States, mostly for kitchen counters. Those countertops have upwards of 95% silica mixed with a polyester resin binder. In order for those countertop slabs to get into our homes, they have to be cut and ground and sanded. And those are done in what are called fabrication shops, mostly by Latino men, who many of whom are working in pretty dusty conditions. So large amounts of silica get airborne when the holes for your sink are cut out or the edges are ground to shape that are necessary for your kitchen counters. The particles are very fine, probably finer than natural stone like marble and granite. And because they're mixed and bound up with a polyester resin to produce these artificial stone countertops, there's probably something unique about the silicosis hazard from artificial stone. So the combination of probably particle size and something about the charge characteristics from this polyester resin. And we're seeing silicosis unlike the silicosis that I've been familiar with since I went to medical school and then began practice in occupational medicine. Relatively rapid onset, some workers as little as 3 years, an average of about 10 years, which is pretty short for silicosis in terms of the latency period. And the disease is very severe. In California, in August, we published the largest case series in the United States. There were 52 workers. The lead author of that is Dr. Jane Fazio, and that's in JAMA in August. And we're now up to 109 cases. So we've more than doubled the number of cases. About 15% of those cases are fatal. And we have 11, I think, transplants with several more waiting to get lung transplants. There's no treatment. This disease is incurable. So obviously for our occupational physicians, we need to recognize this early. As my colleague, Dr. Bob Cohn, who studied silicosis in Australian miners, said the other day, where we have a sick worker, we could have a sick workplace. I really like that expression. I'm going to borrow it because where there's a worker or a patient of ours with silicosis, there are probably other workers similarly exposed who are at risk or have the disease.
Thank you for that wonderful summary. And, you know, it's interesting how you describe this as an old disease that sort of has come back in a new way. So to summarize, would it be fair to say that workers who work with engineered stones, things like workers who make things like quartz countertops, are at risk for exposure to silica particles through inhalation, and they're at risk for developing silicosis, and that's something that providers should be looking out for?
Absolutely. And so taking that history, if you suspect silicosis, ask somebody if they're a stone cutter. Do they work on stone is the simple way that I ask the question. And if they're relatively young, especially, the chances are very good that they're going to be working in a stone fabrication shop. There are control measures that can be put in place. Working with this product covered with water so that the edge of the countertop is ground or sanded completely wet all the time. There are good capture or ventilation devices either on the tool or with special hoods that the product can be worked next to. There's automated equipment to make these cross cuts. And then as a final line of protection, wearing powered air purifying respirators. OSHA has a very comprehensive silica standard. And in California, we just passed an emergency standard. I talk about that in my webinar. And among other things, it requires medical testing. So having these workers get silica medical exams with occupational medicine experts or folks who know how to implement the silica rule for medical testing is also really crucial.
So this kind of leads into some of the unanswered questions. You know, you had many questions that that people who attended the webinar asked, and there are a lot of questions we didn't have a chance to get to. And what I'll do now is kind of pose some of those questions to you. And you talked about this a little bit, but one of the attendees was wondering, does wetting stone and wearing a respirator work for protection, or do these workers need a PAPR or a combination of the above?
Wetting stone is one of the most effective ways to reduce exposure. NIOSH, the National Institute for Occupational Safety and Health, one of their researchers in their controlled technology labs, has been publishing some really interesting papers. The last one that came out showed that by cutting it wet with a sheet of water over the surface, continuous water flow was probably the most effective way of reducing silica dust exposure. But there were still some times when, even with that, the silica levels were above the permissible level set by OSHA, in which case a respirator would have to be also be worn in addition to the wet methods. The new emergency standard in California requires the use of a PAPR, a power air purifying respirator, regardless. So anytime the surface of that countertop is disturbed, OSHA is now requiring employers to have their employees in PAPRs. That's going to be in effect till January 1st of 2025. And Cal-OSHA is starting the process of advisory committees to get input for a permanent rule on fabrication shops for next January. And as they go through that process, I think there's going to be considerable discussion about whether, with proper engineering controls, the use of a PAPR would be absolutely necessary. And that's going to really depend on what exposure data we have, you know, to see, because a PAPR is relatively expensive compared to a regular air purifying respirator. And these are small employers. And so there's some financial burden attached to this, but we obviously want to do the best we can to protect folks from silicosis. And really have this driven, I think, by exposure and science to determine what we call the protection factor, you know, which is much higher with a PAPR. Right now, the simple answer is until January 1st, it's a PAPR.
And what do you think we need to do in terms of new regulation?
Well, I mentioned that we're not going to have anything with a new regulation in California until January 1st, 2025. In December of 2023, we passed an emergency temporary standard, and that by law is effective for 6 months. It's going to probably be renewed for another 6 months, and then it has to be transitioned to a permanent regulation for fabrication shops. One of the innovative parts of this regulation is it sets what are called trigger tasks. So under the existing silica rule, the OSHA silica rule, silica air sampling, respirable crystalline silica air sampling is required to demonstrate a hazard. And what we found were a lot of shops were just simply not doing or couldn't afford or couldn't get the technical help to do that respirable crystalline silica air sampling to trigger things like medical monitoring and respirators and engineering controls. So now, wherever the surface of the stone is disrupted, grinding, sanding, cutting, etc., it is assumed that there's a hazard and all the other elements of the standard should be implemented. I don't have a crystal ball with 100% certainty, but I'm gonna suggest that that will probably remain in place in a new standard, that the trigger task concept would probably remain in place. We're getting new and better data on what sort of engineering controls will reduce exposures in fabrication shops. That might also get incorporated into a permanent standard. One of the elements that I've been discussing with my occupational and pulmonary colleagues is whether we either highly recommend or require low-dose CT in replacement of or in addition to the current requirement, which is a chest X-ray with B-read. Low-dose CT in several good papers out of Australia, they have really great data on this population there, shows that low-dose CT is much better. It's much more sensitive in detecting silicosis than a standard chest film with a B-read. It's obviously access and cost is a challenge, but stay tuned. I think, you know, having input from the occupational medicine or pulmonary community, I think is really important in our policy setting.
So we kind of had a chance to talk a little bit about the state of California and these regulations that you mentioned. One of our attendees was wondering whether you know of any data with respect to other states that may have smaller fabrication shops.
Federal OSHA, you know, sort of the mothership, right, that promulgated the comprehensive silica standard in 2016, which California then adopted because we're a state plan state. Federal OSHA has a relatively new national emphasis program. They call it an NEP that's focused in part on stone fabrication shops in the federal OSHA regions around the country. Federal OSHA is implementing that over the next several months and will be collecting air sample data. One of the questions that I'm often asked is this just a California problem, Dr. Bob? How come we're publishing 52 cases? And there's a couple of other cases that have been published as a case report out of New York, a single case report out of Florida. We co-published with our colleagues from Colorado, Washington, and Texas, a total of 18 cases in 2019. But we're sort of clearly the focus of this problem in the United States. So I think we will have good exposure data after the federal OSHA NEB and National Emphasis Program. And those will be from other parts of the country like Texas, Florida, Arizona.
Which kind of leads into the next question of one of our attendees, which is, you know, do you think that, and I know you said you don't have a crystal ball, but the question the attendee asked is whether you have any predictions about whether other states would follow suit with what California is doing. And it maybe sounds like this collection of data in other states maybe could prompt that.
It is certainly possible and something I would personally like to see California, as we often do, lead the way on really good health protective and occupational medicine practice. I think there are 25 states that have their own OSHA programs, and they each can, if they chose or were, you know, if we worked with them as occupational medicine practitioners, promulgate a tougher standard for fabrication shops like we have in California. Because states can go beyond and get tougher than the federal standards. They can't get weaker, but they can get tougher. Now, the other 25 states are under the federal OSHA jurisdiction, and they could not follow the lead of California individually. They would have to follow the federal OSHA rules. Federal OSHA is in the midst of several other really high profile, fairly complex rulemaking. For instance, an outdoor heat standard, an aerosol transmissible disease standard, to name just a few.
So I think continuing our zoom out from California to the United States, and now an even bigger look, one of our attendees was wondering whether there are any international collaboratives that are working to create international standards for engineered stone use and subsequent disease reporting.
To answer the latter part of the question first, international disease reporting, there's a voluntary collaborative led by colleagues at National Jewish. Leonard Guo, GUO, has published a paper on the last year. The concept of a registry, an occupational silicosis disease registry, that's gotten off the ground, but it is voluntary and relies on a collegial network. There is no worldwide occupational disease registry. The World Health Organization, for example, has an occupational health office, but cases are voluntarily reported, and there's no mechanism that I know of. There have been reports, excellent research reports, out of Israel, Spain, and most recently, many, many great research papers out of Australia and our colleagues there. Australia probably has led the way in terms of research and policy making. In December, the government of Australia decided to ban engineered stone, which will take effect in, I think it's June or July of this year, in just several months, with content more than 40% silica. So they set the threshold at 40% silica content or more. And that is after really careful analysis by occupational hygienists in Australia, occupational medicine and pulmonary disease societies, trade unions, and they just decided, okay, the best course from a public health perspective is to ban high silica content engineered stone.
Yeah, it sounds like Australia is making a lot of progress on this issue. And one of our attendees was wondering about whether medical surveillance in California has been mapped against medical surveillance protocols that may exist in Australia.
You know, I always hate to admit it, Rupesh, but I think Australia is doing better in that regard. It gets my little competitive juices flowing a little bit. Australia has offered medical examinations, including low-dose CT scans, and they have a fund to provide support for that medical testing and surveillance with centralized data collection and compensation for disease. So they get it wrapped up in a much less complicated package than our system in California and generally in other states. I just heard that they have a fantastic low-dose mobile CT unit that has been built and is going around screening minors in Australia and collecting really good data. I really think that's a terrific model and a goal to which I aspire.
Well, let's, for our final question from our attendees, let's move from kind of the medical side of this to the legal side. And one of our attendees was wondering whether there have been any lawsuits against these manufacturers.
There have been, but let me just, and I'll explain that in a second, but just let me back up. In our data that we published in August, of those 52 cases, just a handful had filed workers' compensation claims. Even though most workers, but not all, had formal employment. There is a not insignificant, and I don't have solid numbers, in what I call informal or semi-formal sector, meaning that stone fabricators are working as independent contractors doing countertop jobs, either individually for home contractors who are calling in orders, or informally for brick and mortar employers, but working as an independent contractor in the shop. And in that situation, you're not going to be eligible for workers' compensation benefits because you don't get a W-2, you're not an employer. So that's one challenge that we have. And that's even before I answer your question about lawsuits against manufacturers, is that, you know, workers should be entitled to workers' compensation benefits. The second question about lawsuits against manufacturers, there have been, I want to say now, several dozen lawsuits filed against a dozen or more global manufacturers of engineered stone. And those are filed in different jurisdictions, venues in California. I've heard the first case maybe coming to trial in June. And those are product liability. Those are, you know, civil cases outside of the workers' compensation system.
Thank you. It's been really great hearing all this information from you. And on behalf of BOMA, I want to sincerely thank you, our speaker, Dr. Robert Harrison, for your time and your effort in helping to educate our field about this incredibly important issue.
You're very welcome. Glad to be here.